from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a state lawmaker accuses Massachusetts House Speaker Robert DeLeo of covering up impropriety and sexual harassment.
These silencing tactics have no place in this House. They cover up misdeeds by politicians and others, and they empower perpetrators to move from one victim to the next.
But Speaker DeLeo is defending his track record.
There have been no settlements relative to any sexual harassment cases.
Our weekend review panel takes up that and other issues. Also, Chessie Prout joins us to talk about her sexual assault and how it prompted her to become an activist for assault survivors.
I feel ready to stand up and own what happened to me, and I'm going to make sure that other people, other girls, other boys know that they can own it too and that they don't have to be ashamed either.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, it's Friday, and we begin our week in review with news from this morning. House Speaker Robert DeLeo addressed the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce today, defending himself and his office against accusations from a state representative who says non-disclosure deals with former State House workers are hiding sexual harassment at the State House. DeLeo says there have been no settlements relative to any sexual harassment cases.
I did not know about it. Check with the people in the office. You know, they had never heard about it. I also feel badly. If that's what she went through, then I feel very badly.
Yesterday, during a House debate on a sexual harassment bill, Methuen State Representative Diana DeZoglio took the floor and said that under duress, she signed agreements that prevented her from talking about rumors, sexual propositions, and the 2011 firing from her job as a lawmaker's aide.
The Speaker's office would not release my 6-week severance pay unless I signed a non-disclosure agreement, including a non-disparagement agreement that legally bound me from discussing what had happened and from criticizing any past, present, or future elected members of this House.
DeZoglio said she's heard from dozens of other House employees who signed similar agreements since 2009 when DeLeo became House Speaker.
I am breaking my NDA because I found out that it's not just me who has been told to be quiet. I'm not the only one with this type of agreement. In my situation, was nothing compared to what others may have experienced.
And the criticism didn't only come from her, but also from Boston State Rep. Angelo Scoscia, the longest-serving member of the House. He accused DeLeo of shielding years of impropriety involving 33 severance agreements.
How much money, public monies, has he spent to silence 33 people.
Well, joining us to talk about this and other top stories of the past week are Tiziana Deering. She's co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, former Boston mayoral candidate, and current special advisor to the Somerville nonprofit called Parenting Journey. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of this case and Speaker DeLeo comments this morning regarding these non-disclosure agreements that a state representative has accused him of using to silence folks? Tiziana.
Well, I always hate to start with it's complicated because at some level it's not. This is bad stuff, right? Mm. But at another level it's complicated because what it combs out are questions of employment, non-disclosure, and harassment. What I can say is women are sexualized. And in workforces or environments where they are at disadvantage of power, they are going to be harassed. And no one should react with shock at the news that a young woman in an environment where she didn't hold power might become subject to harassment. We cannot anymore ever express shock when something like that comes to light. Mm. It's not shocking anymore. Hopefully, we'll get to the point where it becomes shocking someday in the future.
Mm-hmm. Tito Jackson.
We have to call it both ways, and I'm a Democrat. But as a Democrat, we have to call out when something is wrong. even in our own party. And this situation here shows, if he didn't know, then that's a management issue, right? Because you're not only a legislator. When you are a leader in that building, that becomes a management issue relative to whether or not you knew. And then also the signing off of public funds, because this is different than the private sector, right? These are all of the money that flows through the state house is literally our money. It is the people's house. So I think that's a critical component. And these issues around NDAs, and Tiziana and I were talking about it earlier, maybe you don't blow them up, but you absolutely, in cases where there is a harassment claim, that can't stand. And as a former public employee, I was not actually allowed to sign an NDA on behalf of the state when I was working for the state, when I was facing private institutions. So I think that's a critical component. And just lastly, you can't just say this is how we've always done business and this is how we do business. Do better, and this is actually about leadership and whether or not we're going to move forward or we're going to stay in the same situation where women's voices are being silenced.
But can't you understand, though? I mean, I can sort of understand as an employee why I would want a non-disclosure agreement. It's not just that it wouldn't disclosing might affect those in power. It could also affect those who want to go on to another job and don't want certain pieces of information revealed. So are you saying we shouldn't have these agreements at all for people who work at the State House?
Yeah, I've thought really hard about this, especially over the last 24 hours, because there are, in fact, times when a non-disclosure agreement protects the person who's been vulnerable.
Right.
And I don't think you want to take a blunt object to this. I think that there are more targeted public policy changes that you can make. What struck me in particular here was this number 33, that there were 33 of these over a 10 or 11 year period. Mm-hmm. I understand there are a lot of employees who come in and out of the State House, but I've been in senior leadership in a number of organizations. At one point, I had 800 employees under my responsibility. I think I have, in one way or another, been party to settlement agreements maybe three times in the last 10 years.
Public institution might be different,
though.
It
might be, but when I think it is reasonable to say, when you are seeing something of that magnitude, a pattern of that magnitude, there could be triggering mechanisms in place to even begin with a confidential investigation or inquiry. But that is a number that suggests that there could be something rotten in the state of Denmark. Mm. And to just cover it up completely, I think, is problematic.
And understand, Rep. DeZoglia, her persistence, and nevertheless, she persisted. So these rumors were bandied about. She was propositioned, as she noted, mm-hmm. At that time. She was fired by her boss over the objection, as I'm told, of the speaker. And then she ran for office, mm-hmm. and she got back and actually won. Mm-hmm. And she's now serving with some of the people who were part of this story. I think there's really something to be said about really thinking about how management occurs there. And this this aperture needs to be broadened, not only around the issue of gender, the issue of race. It also needs to be looked at relative to the issue of people who are disabled. So in the city of Boston and the state of Massachusetts, we must absolutely do better. And the Me Too movement applies to every place, in particular those places that are public and are dealing with public resources.
What are we to make of the fact that two Democrats, DeZoglio and Scotia, a long-serving House member, are the ones who came forward? This was sort of a dramatic display of defiance, really, by Democrats against the speaker here, saying, you know, Speaker DeLeo, we don't think you're doing right by these folks. Is there some message there?
Well, I think in general, one of the things that we've learned from the Me Too movement is no one gets to hide behind this anymore. This is intolerable in all workplaces. Mm. And anybody or any institution or any set of processes or common practices that make it continue to be possible to harass women in the workplace, to create a management environment where certain employees can't perform their best and are either humiliated or driven out, is unacceptable regardless of other kinds of tribal affiliations. And I think that's part of what we saw here.
Hmm. You know, I just want to play a piece of tape here. It's House Speaker DeLeo, because all of this came up, as we said in the beginning, during debate on a sexual harassment bill. So Speaker DeLeo, this is what he said today regarding that sexual harassment bill that they were debating and acting on yesterday.
What we did yesterday, I'm not sure if any other state in this country has done in terms of trying to make a real reasonable effort to attack sexual harassment. And I think, unfortunately, that sort of got lost in the whole translation.
Tina Jackson, this measure that was dealt with by the House yesterday, step in the right direction?
Well, the objective is noble, and I think from a structural perspective, that is a good law. But when it comes down to it, the Representative DeZoglia had to fight to get her voice heard on the floor. From what I'm told, she actually had to scream at the top of her lungs to ensure that she was actually able to speak on this. So it is critical that as we are passing legislation that is about giving women and people of color and people with disabilities an opportunity to speak, that we actually follow that tone and tenor in our actual actions. So I think we have a lot of work to do. And I think that we can't be recalcitrant. We actually have to step up and do the work. And as a man, there's an opportunity for men to actually advance these causes. And it takes not doing the same old thing, but to actually break the mold and do the right thing by the people of the city of Boston, the state of Massachusetts, and the women who actually you serve with.
Can we move on to student walkouts? Let's move on to the national school walkouts on Wednesday. These were a show of solidarity, really, with the students in Parkland, Florida. Call for gun control. And in Boston, where most schools had a snow day, unfortunately, but hundreds of kids did rally at the State House. We spoke with Amalia Hawkman, who's a sophomore at Somerville High School, and she told Radio Boston why she wanted to get involved.
I want to stand up, and I want to stand in solidarity, and I want to make sure that this country and these schools and our streets are safer for the generations to come.
But there are some concerns being expressed the Second Amendment, of course, constitutional rights, gun owners. Jim Wallace, the executive director of the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts, urged members to document the student rallies. And he said that they had concerns that the students and maybe some of the adults with the students might have an anti-civil rights agenda. Let's listen.
You don't see us out there threatening people that if they don't come to see our way, we're going to protest at your house or blow up your Twitter feeds or, you know, try to get people to stop doing business with you. We don't do any of that. All of that comes from the other side.
So, Tiziana Deering, these were first. Let's before we react to Jim Wallace and that part of it, let's react to the students in general. Biggest protests since the Vietnam War. Do you think they're making a difference?
Yeah. Thank you for allowing us to start with the beautiful part. I really appreciate that because yes, and I'll tell you why. One, I do think they're going to make a public policy difference, actually, and some of the signs are just brilliant. We rail against social media a lot, but clearly, young people are learning the power of messaging, and we saw a lot of that. To me, the greater thing is we are a struggling nation, and we are a divided nation, and to see young people all over the country come together in genuine solidarity with each other and embracing solidarity is so inspiring in and of itself that I think we should mark that on top of everything else, that what our 17-year-olds, our 16-year-olds, our 8-year-olds, our 10-year-olds want to do is be in solidarity with each other is an instinct that should be deeply supported and celebrated regardless of anything else. And so I love starting from that place and discussing this particular moment.
Tito.
And it shows what a great education can do. What we see from our young people, and I'm going to brag on the Boston Public Schools, 2 years ago, right around the same time, over 4,000 Boston Public School students stood up and said, we want our money. And we are not going to stand idly by as the administration was underfunding the Boston Public Schools. Interestingly, they blamed the march on me. And other adults. What we see this go around, though, is that you see a national, I would say awakening, but in young people's terminology, I'll say an awakening of people. And what you actually see, even more than what's happening at Congress, they did something that adults hadn't been able to do. You change what's on Walmart's shelf. You change what's on Kroger's shelf. First of all, I didn't know Kroger. I've gotten cereal from Kroger, but I didn't know they sold guns, right? You change what's happening at Dick's. So when it comes down to even being more powerful than legislatures, they were actually able to change the policies of some of the largest for-profit institutions in the United States. And that didn't happen with adults screaming this for years and years. These are the leaders that we need to see, and they are uniquely designed for this time. They are kicking the NRA's butt online. They have more Twitter followers, more Instagram followers, and they're kicking butt. And in 2 years, by the way, probably about 50% of those young people who walked out, and not of all of them walked out in blue states, a lot of them walked out in red states, they will be able to change the mix in this space. One other piece, they're running for office. I saw a 13-year-old who's running for governor in one state. You know what? They need to be part of this mix, and I am so proud. And by the way, it means some of us need to step back and move aside and let young people do it because they're doing a better job than us.
Okay, but what do you say about this other side here? You know, the folks like Jim Wallace, right? They say, you know what? There are some kids who, I know both of you want to talk about this, but we'll give Tiziana Deering just a quick shot here, because really, seriously, what about people who are worried about constitutional rights, who may support more gun rights? And, you know, some folks said, you know, if my kids took the other position here, they were bullied at school. They shouldn't be bullied, right? We need to be open to everybody's opinion here. How do we deal with that?
Yeah, so first, at the youth-to-youth level, nobody should be bullied.
Right.
And if kids are bullied, that's got to stop. I mean, we can just, that is a full stop. That's one conversation. When I heard the recording, as you saw my reaction, I often try to be eloquent, but all I could think was, dude, really? And I think part of that is the NRA and gun activism is doing just fine. They're doing just fine in terms of their ability to make Second Amendment claims at the public policy level. To risk the sense that we are intimidating children in order to protect a set of rights that all data suggests are protected just fine means that you are so in love with your cause that you're willing to intimidate kids to do it. And I'm sorry, I'm just going to say that. And I think it was really wrongheaded.
Trayvon Martin, stand your ground. Black Lives Matter, that has been fighting for these issues for the past 5 years. And now, yes, we do have a watershed relative to these issues. So one, I want to frame this also in a racial context, because we do need to note there have been hundreds of black people whose bodies have laid down on the ground in the past 5 years as this has happened. And people have screamed and they've walked out and they've done the same thing. I believe this is our articulation point. But I believe, as Tiziana just said, there's a disproportionality in the NRA's voice. You're getting too much props. And so when it comes down to what's going on, it's now time to hear the voices of these young people. And you better not threaten them, because that's what, when I hear a gun rights organization telling people to go take pictures, right? So these are individuals who have guns, right? Because that's kind of the basis of what they do. And you're telling them to go interface and interact with our children. That to me, my hair's getting raised on my arms on what that looks like. And so I will be there to ensure that I'm with young people to ensure that they're safe. And I think I want to see adults step up and have young people's back, let them have the front. But we need to be there to ensure that other adults who are not acting like adults are not interfacing and interacting or intimidating our young people. You will not do that. And so that's another component that we need to think about. Your voice has been heard. These young people don't have lobbyists. In Congress, their lobbyists are actually supposed to be elected officials, not always on their side. So I think there's really something to be said about those words and how they're being framed and what he is asking his members to do in terms of the interface and interaction with young people. We will not let it stand.
So for the listeners who might write off what I said, let me be clear. I came up in Michigan. I come from gun people. right? Mm. I grew up with guns. I have family members who hunt and own lots of guns, right? This is about disproportionality. This is about intimidating kids. And this is about, and I'm going to say this one too, claiming the language of civil rights in a context Amen. That is heavily racialized in the first place, that is disproportionate and inappropriate given the voice. And I believe that somewhere at their heart, they knew that.
And this is not anti Second Amendment. Having a background check, right? Understand, you go get a credit card. They do a credit check on you. If you have a car and I want to sell Tiziana my hoopty, what has to happen, however ugly my car is, I have to sign paperwork when it comes to the transacting of that vehicle from one person to another. That does not happen in the secondary market with something like a gun. Having these mental health issues, and this is the fallback around the Second Amendment, folks, and they're saying it's about mental health. We're not saying it's not about mental health. We're saying that it is about mental health, and that if you have mental health issues, you should not be able to get a gun, like you can in Florida and other states, where you can literally walk in and then walk out with a gun. These are common sense approaches to gun control. And in the state of Massachusetts, we have some of the best laws around this. And guess what? We have some of the lowest number of these types of incidents.
But if we talk just about the debate here and what's going on and the way the kids are coming forward and the way they're influencing the debate or legislation possibly, you mentioned what happened 2 years ago, Tito, when students walked out in Boston. But I think educators are walking a fine line here, right? They really are not supposed to be taking a political stance. And that's what we heard from the Association of School Superintendents that said, you know what, this is a school safety issue that the students should be talking about, not necessarily gun control. Is it possible for educators to walk that line here, and how do they do it? Let's start with you because you brought up Boston.
This is compulsory education. You're required to be in a school from age 6 to 16 in the United States of America. We are putting people and requiring them to go to this school, and they're demanding, hey, you're making this requirement. We want to be safe while this is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And so with that, the people who don't want to talk about this cast it as political. This is life or death for the young people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. This is life or death for many of the young people in urban neighborhoods where, by the way, they actually have metal detectors at their school. And this school doesn't sound like it had it. So when it comes down to it, these young people are not politicizing this. They are actually, to me, breaking it down to what has to happen for them to be able to go to school safely and to learn safely and not having in the back of their mind whether or not they're going to have to make a literal life or death situation. They should be choosing classes or colleges, not whether or not they're going to be shot, killed, maimed, or harmed. Mm-hmm.
Nothing I could disagree with in that.
Okay.
I would say we should acknowledge that Massachusetts is a bubble. I was in Georgia yesterday, and we were talking about this. And somebody said to me, well, you know, what happened up where you are? And I'm like, I'm in Massachusetts, right? I can tell you that what happened in Massachusetts was different than what happened all over Georgia, right? So we should acknowledge that teachers were free to take a level of stance up against that fine line in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that they might not have been in other states. And we should recognize that. We are more in lockstep in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts on this issue in particular than people in other states may be.
Okay, we're not going to be able to get any more issues in if we don't move on here. So let's go to the debate over possibly renaming Yawkey Way, the street that runs alongside Fenway Park and is named for former Red Sox owner Tom Yawkey. Yesterday, Boston's Public Improvement Commission heard supporters and opponents of this proposal to rename the street. Now, this was requested by the Red Sox because of Tom Yawkey's legacy against integrating the team. And several prominent city nonprofits, many that benefit from the generosity of the Yawkey Foundation, signed a letter urging the city not to change the name of the street. Among those signatories, Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley. Now, this letter was presented to the commission yesterday by a trustee of the Yawkey Foundation, Reverend Ray Hammond of the Bethel AME Church in Boston. Let's listen.
There's just no evidence for the notion that Tom Yawkey was a virulent racist who would call Jackie Robinson the term, or that there was absolutely deliberate foot dragging and no efforts whatsoever to integrate the team.
So rename Yawkey Way or not, Tito Jackson.
It is unfortunate that Yawkey Foundation are attempting to revise history on the backs of those who fought for racial equality in the city of Boston. It is. Let's look at the actions here. I don't know. I'm too young to have had a conversation with this man. But when you pass over Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays, and you're the last team in the league to have a black player, then you. And also, there are MCAD claims. There's a history here that has showed that the policies and processes at this time were racist. And so when it comes to Boston, and we get labeled whether or not we are the most racist city or mm-hmm. not. The question is, are we the most accepting city or not? And I give props to the Boston Red Sox for doing something that's uncomfortable, something that actually can lose them money, because the status quo here actually allows for the Red Sox to keep going and make even more money this season. I want to give props to the management there for doing the right thing and actually moving forward and advancing us in the right direction. I want to see more people in the front office. They have the first manager of color. They have double the number of African American players that abound in the whole in their league. Mm. So I think there's a lot to be said about what the Red Sox can do. But this is an absolute step in the right direction. And I'm sorry to hear that the Yawkey Foundation, which is doing great work, by the way, that's a separate, I'm sorry about that, I'm getting excited, but that's a separate conversation right. as to the work of the Yawkey Foundation, which does spectacular work, versus the owner of the team, Mr. Tom Yawkey at that time.
But they're saying, essentially, that are there other ways to confront the legacy of these institutions or the streets, and why change it?
It's at the front door. Understand. This is literally at the front door of the park. It speaks and understand why we name streets in modern times for someone. It's a laudatory act based on something that individual has done. And so if we want to co-sign on that, then we can continue to perpetuate that. But I don't believe, as a city of Boston who's dealing with the Globe series around race, who's dealing with my election relative to whether or not we've actually had a person of color as a leader. We're one of the only two cities over 450,000 that hasn't had a leader of a mayor of color in the United States of America. It's only us in Indianapolis. We have a lot of work to do, and I believe the Red Sox should be given props for the work that they're doing and doing something difficult. This is not an easy thing, and from a marketing perspective, teams such as the Red Sox, they should stay the middle. They should actually just play the middle and just make their money. You know what? I think they are taking a stand here. And I think the foundation and the great work they do versus changing this name are two separate issues. And changing the name is absolutely the right thing to do.
Tiziana.
So I was struck by the fact that it was Reverend Hammond who was coming out in support of keeping the name the same. I listened to him. And he has, I think he's a wise man, and he has a lot of influence on me. And I read that letter, and I looked at the signatories. I used to be the president of one of the organizations mm-hmm. that signed on to that letter. Mm-hmm. Those organizations are supported by the money of the Yawkey Foundation. I wish everybody behaved differently in this particular situation. I wish the Red Sox, as was discussed on Radio Boston here yesterday, mm-hmm. presented it as the business need that it is. I wish that the Yawkey Foundation chose not to see this as central to their reputation and legacy, because that is in their philanthropy and it's good. And I wish that we could recognize that it's been called Yawkey Way longer than he was owner of the Red Sox, and it's fine to now call it something else and have let that have been the thing that was laudatory for a period of time that it was even longer than he owned the team, and now we can call it something else. So I wish we had framed this entire thing in another context, because it would still allow us to recognize that Boston has a racial history that it needs to come to grips with, and the Red Sox have a racial history they need to come to grips with. That's true no matter what.
And I think this is a continuation of them coming to grips, the ownership team actually stepping forward and making some of these public changes relative to this issue. I call on the Red Sox and my friend and actually classmate Sam Kennedy. We actually went to the best high school in the world, Brookline High School, to continue the conversations that they've been having, but also to continue to diversify the front office of that organization, to diversify what they put on the field, and also to diversify the vendors that they have at the organization. There's a great deal of work to do, but I think we need to continue forward in this discomfort, because one of the things I also kind of heard that this is uncomfortable. You know what? It is. Yes, it's uncomfortable to talk about race, class, and gender. We need to sit with this discomfort and actually move through it instead of around it, and we have an opportunity to do that, and I call on the Red Sox to continue to lead. We also need to note this happened at a time Willie O'Ree from the Bruins was the first black player in the NHL. Chuck Cooper was the first black player for the Boston Celtics, drafted by Red Auerbach. They led. Now it's time for the Red Sox to lead.
All right, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor, former mayoral candidate, now with the Somerville nonprofit Parenting Journey. Thanks very much for coming in. Also, Tiziana Deering, co-director of the Center for Social Innovation at Boston College and a member of WBUR's Executive Advisory Board. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A major Democratic upset in Pennsylvania this week, where former Marine and prosecutor Connor Lamb beat the Republican candidate Rick Saccone in a district that went for President Trump by 20 points in 2016. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton endorsed Lamb, who's a fellow veteran. Moulton says Lamb represents a new generation of Democratic leaders. For more on this and on Moulton's involvement, we're joined by WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for coming in.
Hey, my pleasure. Nice to see you, Deb.
So always a Massachusetts angle.
Yep.
I guess, no matter where we are. Moulton, Democrat from Salem, was an early supporter of Lamb in Pennsylvania, and you spoke with Moulton about this today. What's their history?
Yeah, well, let's go back to last September. So Congressman Seth Moulton went out to Iowa to the Polk County Steak Fry. This is an event that's organized by local Democrats in Iowa. And at the time, Moulton's trip to the first presidential caucus state fueled speculation that he was considering a presidential run of his own. But last fall, the Salem Democrat said he was in Iowa to advocate for a slate of fellow veterans and Democrats running for Congress. Here's a bit of what he said.
12 veterans I've endorsed so far in swing districts across the country, exactly the districts we need to take back if we're going to take back the House. One of my messages here, there's help on the way, and it's coming in the form of a new generation of Democrats who understand public service and are going to start winning again.
And that was last fall, Anthony. What's Moulton saying today?
All right. Well, first of all, his slate of endorsed candidates is now up to 19 veterans. Connor Lamb is one of them. And Moulton worked hard to help him win. He raised nearly $80,000 for Connor Lamb. He campaigned door-to-door with him in Pennsylvania. He had six of his staff members working in Pittsburgh. And so that contributed that helped Lamb beat Rick Saccone, a four-term Pennsylvania state rep in a district that, as you mentioned, Trump won by 20 points in 2016. So here's what Seth Moulton said today to me about his involvement.
Some people have credited me with recruiting some of these veterans to run, and there's a few that I did encourage. But the best recruiter out there is our commander-in-chief, Donald Trump. He's the one who's convinced so many veterans to stand up and take on the Republican establishment, to take on the president and serve the country again.
So remind us, Anthony, what kind of campaign Connor Lamb ran and how he pulled off this upset victory.
Well, Lamb ran as a moderate Democrat, a Marine veteran who, like Seth Moulton, promised to oppose Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi, and whose campaign ad featured a picture of him shooting an AR-15-style assault rifle. He promised to work with Democrats and Republicans in Washington. So a sort of middle-of-the-road Democrat.
And now some Republicans have suggested that Lamb was a Democrat in Republicans' clothing and that he sort of got the win by running as a fake Democrat. What does Congressman Moulton say to that?
Well, Congressman Moulton calls that a ridiculous attack line. And he points out correctly, actually, that many of Connor's positions place him squarely in the mainstream to moderate sort of Democratic camp. He's in favor of gun rights, but he's also in favor of universal background checks. Personally, he's opposed to abortion, but he's unwilling to upend abortion rights. He opposed the Republican tax plan. He supports Obamacare. And Lamb is supportive of legal medical marijuana. And it is worth asking if he was a fake Democrat or a Republican in Lamb's clothing.
Right.
Why did Republicans invest $10 million in trying to defeat him?
Good question. So what do you think his victory signals for the midterm elections?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it signals a big challenge for Republicans as they try to hold on to their majorities in Congress, particularly in the House. Lamb's victory was fueled by an energized electorate, and that's what Democrats need. It included college-educated suburban progressives, and it included blue-collar workers. So that's a pretty powerful coalition right there. Seth Moulton says Lamb was a candidate who understood his district and that his experience as a veteran gave him real credibility.
Now we have a new generation of leaders who have seen the consequences of failed leadership in Washington and places like Iraq or Afghanistan. I think you see the generation of veterans who went to Iraq and Afghanistan taking over for the generation that sent us there.
So Deb Moulton says veterans like Connor Lamb are in a unique position to challenge what's wrong with Washington. He's hopeful they can help Democrats win in November. We'll see if that happens.
Right. WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. You can hear more of his reporting on All Things Considered starting at 4 today. Anthony, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Deb. Have a good weekend.
You too. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Our next guest is going to talk about her journey from anonymous victim in a high-profile sexual assault case to outspoken advocate for assault survivors. In 2014, when Chessie Pratt was a freshman at the elite St. Paul's boarding school in Concord, New Hampshire, she accused senior Owen LaBrie of sexually assaulting her. She said it was part of a campus ritual called Senior Salute, where senior boys would seek out encounters with younger students. The so-called St. Paul's rape trial captured national headlines. LaBrie was cleared of a felony rape charge, but he was convicted on 3 counts of misdemeanor charges, which she's appealing. During the trial, Prout's name was withheld, but she's since come forward, and she's co-written a memoir titled I Have the Right To, a high school survivor's story of sexual assault, justice, and hope. Chessie Pratt, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Jen Abelson. She's a reporter for the Boston Globe Spotlight team, and she's co-author of the memoir. Jen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So how are you doing now, Chessie, 4 years later?
It's definitely been a process, a healing process of moving forward. And, I mean, right now, I am enjoying my gap year, doing my job, which was writing this book. And working with Jen has been really great because she's helped me put my story together in a clear and concise way.
Why was it important for you to come forward?
For me, I mean, my name was already blasted on the darkest parts of the internet. Hate sites popped up with my name, my address, photos of my house, photos of my family, our phone numbers and emails. And people wrote death threats and rape threats online. And so I kind of wanted to reclaim the internet and reclaim my name and story by coming forward. And St. Paul's counterfiling to our lawsuit really helped push me over the edge to do that.
So we should just explain that a little bit. Your family filed a civil suit against St. Paul's, and they threatened to reveal your name. And
yes.
So that was why you decided to first come forward on the Today Show, right?
Yes, that is.
Yeah, and they did threaten to use your name. As a tactic in the lawsuit, I think people would be surprised by that.
Yes, absolutely. There are so many used and known and true, tried and true tactics that big institutions and perpetrators use to silence victims. And I wanted to try to change that.
Mm-hmm. I wonder why this book now then, too? Why do this?
Well, over the last couple of years, I've been privileged to meet all these different survivors and advocates. And when I was still an anonymous victim, Charlie Pillsbury, another alumni from St. Paul's School, wrote an op-ed in the Hartford Courant, and he told his story of sexual assault at St. Paul's School, and this was maybe 60 years later. And so the fact that I could help somebody as an anonymous 15-year-old girl reconcile with their assault and kind of feel open enough to talk about it meant a lot to me. So I feel as though if I keep on talking about it, maybe that'll help other survivors come forward and come to terms with what's happened to them.
Hmm. Do you ever regret coming forward? It sounds like it was such an ordeal.
Some days I do wish that I could just be, you know, a normal kid. But then again, what is normal these days? We've seen so many youth and kids become activists in so many different realms. And I feel really lucky to be able to have a voice in this arena because too often I felt helpless.
Right. Jen, I want to ask you about this and about your reporting for the Boston Globe Spotlight team. What have you found in terms of what's happening at some of the elite private schools in particular, like St. Paul's? We heard in the trial about that practice known as senior salute, where senior boys would try to have sexual encounters with young girls and compete with each other for numbers of sexual encounters. I mean, is this unique to St. Paul's, would you say, or is this sort of common among schools to have a sense of entitlement among many of the particularly young men there?
In 2016, I spent a year with my Spotlight team colleagues investigating sexual misconduct at private schools, and it was definitely, we journeyed into this world of privilege and elitism. It was a very insular culture where there was a huge sense of entitlement and sexism, and that allowed not only horrific abuse of boys, but girls as well. And we found, we examined a lot of cases of faculty-to-student sexual misconduct, but also cases of student-to-student, and so I think Chessie's case is her own story, her own journey, but the idea of boys having sexual conquest games, unfortunately, is not unique to them.
And why do you think that is? I mean, is there some sort of entitlement in certain private elite schools, do you think, that is fostered more so than maybe other schools?
I think in particular in the boarding schools and some of the private schools that don't have a day students, where it becomes a very insular culture and there's not an infusion of oxygen, it really allows administrators who are not paying close attention to the culture to promoting healthy relationships and consent to allow this kind of toxic culture to occur. But I will say it's not unique to just private schools. It's sort of these problems of rape culture and sexual conquest games are you know, common, unfortunately, in both public and private schools.
In response to this book, St. Paul's released a statement to the Globe that said, "We're proud of the culture we've built at our school and our care for students. The school's culture does not condone or tolerate what happened to Chessie, and students understood senior salute to refer to a range of consensual behavior. It was never a tradition." Chessie, what do you say to that statement?
Well, I'd just kind of point to the proof and the actions. I mean, the senior salute was acknowledged as a tradition in a handbook, in a little red book done as an independent student project, which was sponsored by a teacher, and it was printed in the school's newspaper. And also, if everything's changed, then why was there another assault last summer? Why was there another sexual conquest game that was introduced last summer through an investigation by the Concord Monitor? And also, until they acknowledge that what happened to me was wrong and what happened to me was a part of a sick tradition at the school, I don't believe any change can really be done.
I want to ask you about social media, because you mentioned activism on the part of young people. So social media has obviously been an amazing tool for that activism. But I think you also, in your book, when you write about it, how it really was damaging in your particular case, and you talked about the threats on social media and the pictures of your house and all of those things. I wonder how you think it affected things, infected the environment at St. Paul's, and what happened to you? Is it harder now, in a way?
I'm not actually quite sure if it would be harder, because, I mean, the fundamental ideas of bullying and of shaming people, I mean, have stayed the same throughout the tale of time. But social media definitely has made it more widespread. You can't just go home and forget about the bullying that happens in the classroom halls or and especially in boarding schools. You're in a dorm, and that follows you everywhere. So social media has been an extremely harmful tool in some ways for kids to make jokes about the age of consent or about consent in general. But it's also been such a positive tool, at least for me, in launching the hashtag I Have the Right To movement, which is the title of the book, and to see the Me Too movement take off as well.
What would you say, both of you, to parents of young men about the Me Too movement and about how do they teach boys how to navigate consent and sex?
Well, I think it's also so important to remember that 1 in 6 boys before the age of 18 are going to be affected by sexual assault. And so this is a human issue. And we need to keep boys and men in the conversation because also about 98% of perpetrators are male. And so talking about consent from a young age to all genders is so important, whether it be from kindergarten where you talk about how you have to ask to hold somebody's hand or ask to give them a hug, or you don't have to give your uncle a kiss if you don't want to. That can help save children from a lifelong bit of trauma.
Hmm. Ken, what are your thoughts about that?
I agree with Chessie. I think the idea of including and engaging men and young boys in this conversation from an early age is imperative. Chessie, as you can see, is wearing this consent is bracelet on her hand, and that's mm-hmm. one of the tools that through an organization that she works with, promoting awareness, victim empowerment, which is just designed for people to claim what consent means to them and to not make it a topic that is anti-men or anti-boy, that it's supporting all people.
Hmm. Chessie, I wonder, are you still sometimes angry?
Oh, absolutely. That has been an important part in my healing process. A lot of times I've worked towards feeling or allowing myself to feel sad instead of angry because, I mean, angry is my first defense mechanism, but I definitely am angered by a lot of different things that have been going on and continue to go on.
Hmm. I wonder if you could read a brief section from your book that we have in front of you. It's on page 157, and I just want to set it up a little bit. In this part of the book, you're speaking with a counselor at St. Paul's, and you're speaking about forgiveness. Can you read that for us?
Sure. This is part of chapter 11 called Numb. The idea that this rabbi or someone else could forgive Owen and set him free made my blood boil. He hadn't shown any remorse or acknowledged any responsibility for his actions. I don't think I'll ever forgive him, I declared. You might never forgive him, Buzz said, but have you forgiven yourself? I twirled that question around in my brain for a while. If I was truly honest, I still blamed myself for not screaming or kicking, for going there in the first place. But now, raw anger was displacing the shame. I was livid at Owen for doing this to me. I was enraged at my classmates for shunning me and calling me a liar. No one blames people who are beaten up and have their wallets stolen, but somehow my peers believed I was at fault for having my virginity stolen.
That's very powerful. Very powerful. What do you want people to take from this?
Well, through this book, I want to show the humanity behind the word victim and survivor. And again, show that we have the right to be angry, be sad, be happy, be anything we want to be throughout this process.
You sound like an advocate already. Are you an advocate?
I felt like a true survivor after finishing testifying in my trial in 2016. But I do believe that I've become a youth advocate or just an advocate in general because I choose to be that, and I choose to want to help other people, but you can be an advocate just by being kind to other people and helping promote consent education and just trying to be an everyday activist.
Hmm. Jen, why co-write this book? Was there something personal for you as well?
I felt deeply connected to Chessie. I share many of the values she shares, which is integrity and truth and accountability, and I was just overwhelmed with her willingness and ability to stand up to such a prestigious institution at a young age and try to hold them accountable, which is something I've tried to do for my whole career. And this issue, I talked to hundreds of victims during my course of my investigation, many who suffered in silence for decades and seen how damaging it was, seen abuse, you know, toxic relationships, abuse of alcohol and drugs. And I felt like Chessie was this incredibly strong voice that could help shatter that silence, that could help people sort of better understand what it means to be a survivor or how to support them.
Hmm. Chessie, you said this was a bit of a gap year while you were writing this. What are you doing now? And you're working to be an advocate, I think, or you should be anyway. So what are you doing now?
My family and I recently relocated to Washington, D.C., where we started our own nonprofit called I Have the Right To. And so we want to use what we've learned through this process to help other families navigate the criminal justice system and their pursuit of justice. And that's just the beginning of that. But I continued to work with PAVE throughout the fall and went into some high school classrooms, actually, to teach 10th grade health classes. And so we taught healthy relationship and consent courses. And it's always really interesting to see students excited to learn about this.
All right. Well, so see, you are an advocate. Still in school?
I'm going to be starting college next year at Barnard.
All right. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Jesse Proud, the author of the new memoir, I Have the Right To, A High School Survivor's Story of Sexual Assault, Justice, and Hope. Also with us was Jen Abelson, a reporter for the Boston Globe Spotlight team and co-author of the memoir. Jen, thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today and for this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.